Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf vetoes a controversial bill that would have made the public wait before knowing the name of a police officer who fires a weapon in the line of duty. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Advocates for more police transparency consider the veto a big win. Law enforcement groups say Wolf's decision could endanger officers' lives. More from WHYY's Bobby Allen.
In his veto memo, Governor Wolf said when police fire their weapons, the public has a right to know as much as possible. Otherwise, he wrote, quote, a harmful mistrust will grow between police officers and communities. But House Republican spokesman Steve Miskin says Wolf's veto is really bad news for police.
When a bill passes with such strong bipartisan support and overwhelming majorities, it's always a little bit surprising and shocking when a governor vetoes a bill like this.
The bill would have kept secret for 30 days the names of cops who shoot at civilians.
This just gives them a little peace of mind as they protect the public that a fair and objective investigation can be conducted and that doesn't put them or their families at risk.
The argument goes if a police officer is named soon after a shooting, many might assume the cop is in the wrong. That could even make someone want to seek retribution. When the bill was introduced, proponents were asked to point to such examples of payback, but they didn't have any. Critics often mention that, while also saying that the bigger risk here is community perception. If it looks like cops are hiding things, the public will respond. Kelvin Anderson is the executive director of the Philadelphia Police Advisory Commission.
If people believe that we're actually going backwards and we are not going to make good on the promise of transparency, I think that that will potentially inflame communities even more in these circumstances.
Former Philadelphia Police Commissioner Charles Ramsey held the same view. Under his leadership, the department started releasing within 72 hours the name of an officer who fires a weapon while on the line of duty. It was a step the Department of Justice recommended to help make police in Philly more accountable in the wake of a noticeable spike in officer-involved shootings in 2012. The bill that Wolf vetoed was trying to pump the brakes on Ramsey's policy.
This bill is the state legislature making a decision for all police departments and all municipalities around the state from the confines of the state capitol.
That's Andy Hoover. He's a lobbyist for the ACLU of Pennsylvania.
We don't want Pennsylvania leading the way in the backlash against what is essentially a new civil rights movement calling for more police accountability.
Some Democrats voted for the bill, but one who spoke out strongly against it was Representative Jordan Harris of Philadelphia. He says, take for instance a mother grieving after a son was fatally shot by police.
And now we are going to bar chiefs of police across this Commonwealth from providing that mother with a name, providing that mother with the thought that the process will not be tainted, that the process will not be rigged against her and her child.
Harris says the best disinfectant is sunlight.
This closes the window. This pulls down the shade. This doesn't let the sunlight in. This keeps communities in darkness. And when communities are in darkness, you see unrest.
The Fraternal Order of Police Lodge 5 in Philly strongly urged Wolf to sign the bill. In a letter expressing his disappointment, Union President John McNesby said Wolf showed disregard for cops by, quote, spinelessly caving to the howling mob of anti-police hate groups. McNesby went on to say that, quote, sadly, once again, a politician has endangered police in order to protect his own thin political hide. Representative Martina White of Northeast Philly has already vowed to reintroduce the legislation next session. So the veto is a win for now for police reform advocates, but the larger battle is on hold until the legislature reconvenes next year, when Republicans have even larger majorities following this year's election. If it becomes law then, Pennsylvania would become the first state to slow the release of an officer's name after a shooting. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
An ambitious and expensive plan to revamp Philadelphia's parks, rec centers, and libraries is getting a big, very big boost. WHYY's Katie Culinary reports that the William Penn Foundation is providing $100 million toward the effort.
It's the largest grant the nonprofit has ever given and covers one-fifth of the funding needed for the initiative Philadelphia calls Rebuild. The seven-year, $500 million plan will focus on repairing and improving parks, rec centers, and libraries, starting in Philadelphia's neediest neighborhoods, where many of these facilities are more than a century old. Speaking at a press conference at Cecil B. Moore Recreation Center in North Philly, Janet Haas with the William Penn Foundation said the size of the grant reflects the nonprofit's faith in the program.
We know that public spaces have a transformative impact on quality of life. It's time for that same kind of transformation we've witnessed, all of us have witnessed in Center City, to take place and sweep into the neighborhoods, into every corner of our city.
But the money comes with some strings attached. Three-quarters of the funding is contingent on Philadelphia City Council approving $300 million in bond sales. At the press conference, Council President Darrell Clark signaled his cooperation.
I mean, I don't foresee a challenge. I mean, in terms of the sizing of our bond, their bond.
A smaller portion of the grant, about $20 million, will be used to help convince other philanthropies and government entities to chip in. The project is a centerpiece of Mayor Jim Kenney's agenda. He called the grant a game changer for the areas the city has neglected.
We will rebuild it and they will come and they will make these neighborhoods productive again and we'll take care of our children the way we always should have taken care of them.
The city is pledging $49 million from its new sweet and beverage tax for the rebuild initiative. I'm Katie Culinary, WHYY News.
And this disclosure, the William Penn Foundation supports WHYY. The climate change conference in Morocco ended over the weekend with an urgent message to President-elect Donald Trump. Join the battle against global warming or risk contributing to catastrophe and moral failure. Around 25,000 people attended the gathering aimed at keeping the Earth from overheating and staving off impacts of climate change, including rising seas, droughts, and increasingly destructive storms. From Marrakesh, State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports on how a group of academics from Pennsylvania attending the conference transformed their initial discouragement into inspiration.
When Moravian College professor Diane Husick woke up the morning after Election Day in Marrakesh, she headed to the United Nations Climate Change Conference with a cloud over her head.
Everybody, Wednesday morning, we came in, and it didn't matter which country you were from, this place was just in a fog. It was really a damper, and everybody that came up and talked to us was saying, oh, did you vote for Donald Trump, and what is that going to mean for us?
Husick is a veteran of these climate change conferences. She's been bringing students to them since 2009. But she never expected that a man who called climate change a Chinese hoax and who vowed to pull the U.S. out of the landmark climate agreement etched out in Paris last year would be leading the country. But like everyone at the climate conference in Morocco, Husick says she quickly switched gears and is returning home to Pennsylvania energized to act on reducing carbon emissions and working at the local level.
I know in the Lehigh Valley, there's a lot of groups getting together because flooding is a big problem, and that, you know, it's the Delaware watershed that we share with Philadelphia. You know, separate of who's in the governor's office or who's in the president's office or position in the White House, a lot of the work is going to be done at the much more local level.
There's a legitimate fear now that if the U.S., which contributes 20% of global carbon emissions, withdraws from the Paris Agreement, the entire global accord could fall apart. The U.S. is also one of the wealthiest nations, and as such, has pledged money to help poor nations adapt. If that money dries up, other countries could back off from their own commitments. Husick's friend, Franco Montalto, is a professor at Drexel University, and he runs an organization dedicated to helping cities adapt to climate change.
And so I guess my message would be, you know, stay calm, stay clear-headed, focus on what needs to be done, and, you know, put your energy into making sure the next election and the midterm elections and your local elections are supporting folks who will really lead in the way we need to be led, not what we've been hearing is going to come out of the new administration.
Sitting under a tent drinking mint tea in the Moroccan desert, Husick, Montalto, and a group of students and professors from eastern Pennsylvania all said they were encouraged by the conference, especially after going through such a divisive election season back home.
Sorry, I had to be late. I think one of the things you can take back as a message is you've got 197 countries here, all with different priorities and urgencies, and yet they can come together and work not only on having gotten the Paris Agreement, but now implementing it. And I walked in this morning and saw all the flags displayed and thought unity. And I guess that's the message I'm going to go back to, that we're all in this together.
All the countries attending the conference pledged to continue no matter what Donald Trump decides to do. But they all left Morocco staring into the unknown. The new administration takes power in just a couple of months. And so far, there has been no word from them regarding climate change. Reporting from Marrakesh, I'm Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
For the first time, planets beyond our solar system are pretty as a picture. Joining me to pose for a profile, Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, this is very exciting to actually see, not merely infer that there are planets beyond our sun's system.
Yeah, every picture tells a story.
Don't it?
And of course, a picture's worth 1,000 words.
Safe to say the big trick was how to factor out that star's illumination so you could see these itty-bitty planets.
Yeah, so this is a combination of equipment that has been brought together to provide this capability. So we use the coronagraph to block the light from the primary star, and then we use the spectrograph to gather light from the attending planets, and that's how we create the picture.
What have we seen?
This is a piece of equipment that is now just beginning its full-time use, and so we've been able to prove the concept that this will work well. And now the idea is to try to use it to identify what the spectral characteristics are of the planets in question. So now we'll begin to understand more about what that composition is. Does it have an atmosphere? What kind of atmosphere does it have? What's the composition of the planet itself?
So we're looking for a very specific quality, and yet there's no question about the quantity. Don't most stars have planets now, as far as what we know?
Well, that's the supposition. One of the things that has come out of the Kepler mission to identify planets orbiting stars here in our own galaxy is that it seems now to make sense that a star is more likely to have planets than not to have planets. So, you know, we have to do a complete survey, of course, to make this work out. But statistically, it looks as if that would be the case. And, of course, we can extend that throughout our galaxy and on to other galaxies. We can't say that there's anything particular about this galaxy that would be conducive to the production of planets that wouldn't be the same at any other galaxy. So, you know, we do the statistical analysis that tells us that this is probably the case, and then we extend that out.
And helping in that research, not merely the land-based telescopes, we can go out of this world as well.
Yes, indeed. So the space-based platform will help us in trying to better see what's going on at these other stars. And to that end, there is a group called Blue Dot, which is crowdsourcing funds to build a space telescope that will be used to get a better look at the exoplanets that have been discovered orbiting the nearby stars Alpha and Beta Centauri.
Those are our closest neighbors?
They are our closest neighbors, 4.2 light years away. And the idea of there being planets orbiting those stars really excites us in that folks are beginning to speculate about creating transportation systems, albeit very, very tiny, that might allow us to access them within 100 to 200 years. Now, that's a remarkable thought. So the ability to better understand the nature of those planets would help to shape a mission of that sort, where we might send a very, very tiny spacecraft at a much higher velocity than we can send anything else to more closely inspect those planets.
We have a moment left. What's available to be seen in the night sky this week?
So this Thanksgiving week, we have great opportunity to observe fabulous things in the evening sky. Venus and Mars are over in the southwest at 5:30 in the evening. It's a great time to take a break from the turkey later this week and just go out and get a breath of fresh air, if you will, and enjoy the evening sky. If you happen to be a person that likes to be up early in the morning at 6 a.m., sunrise has not come yet, just in the offing, and that gives you the opportunity to see Jupiter and the moon Thursday morning and Friday morning this week, and they'll be great sights. So give it a try.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. In the weeks after President-elect Donald Trump's upset victory over Hillary Clinton, information is emerging about what his cabinet might look like. Early on, the president-to-be released a list of his so-called transition team. Headed by Vice President-elect Mike Pence, the group's full of high-profile Trump supporters, many of whom seem likely to score cabinet jobs. WHYY's Katie Meyer reports that for Pennsylvanians, Two of the names on the list may look familiar.
GOP Congressman Lou Barletta and Tom Marino, who represent districts in central and northeast Pennsylvania, were two of Trump's earliest supporters in Congress. They were rewarded with high-profile positions on the campaign trail. Team Trump nicknamed the pair Thunder and Lightning, and they served more or less as the opening act at many rallies. Here's Marino at one event.
Well, Lou and I, we're sort of interchangeable. And we're newer members, and we're tired of the establishment in D.C. Are you?
Barletta is considered a hardliner on immigration. Marina, who served as Lycoming County's district attorney, professes similar values. Details are scarce on what exactly is next for the two congressmen. Both Marino and Barletta declined to be interviewed. In a statement, Barletta called his appointment a great honor. Katie Meyer in Harrisburg.
Most people will never hold office, and for some, voting is as political as it gets, though more than a quarter of Pennsylvanians volunteer, and that's one of the highest rates nationwide. Keystone Crossroads Margaret J. Krause spent time with some Pittsburgh volunteers who work at their own versions of civic duty.
Joan Valet marches across a busy kitchen. She's red-cheeked and covered in flour, orchestrating a massive production for the group she runs, the Christian Mothers. They're churning out hundreds of dozens of pierogies at Prince of Peace Parish, a Catholic church on Pittsburgh's south side.
You're going to have to make a whole new thing of potatoes here.
All the money they make supports the church and its outreach. Belay says she believes in volunteering. She even became the reluctant president of the group.
I'm not real good at standing up and speaking. I'm like real shy on that. And everybody said, well, John, you should do it because you do a lot for the church. They want me to run again, so I guess I'm stuck with it now.
Three women used ice cream scoops to lay out rows of pierogi guts. One of them, Donna Janiak, says it's important to give back. And as far as the election and the future of government, it's all a lot easier to handle when you eat well.
Throw some extra butter and onions on it. It'll all go down.
Once the scoopers fill a tray, it's delivered to the pinchers, a squad of older ladies who seal the pierogies before they're cooked.
Usually when they float, they're good.
Janet Sundy and her son are regulars at the biannual event. She says it helps the church, and it's fun.
You have to believe in something bigger than yourself. You are responsible for your community, and you do have to do things.
28% of Pennsylvanians volunteered in 2015. They mentored youth, collected food, and pitched in for religious organizations. But is volunteering and contributing to the public good part of our civic duty? Barb Feig is deputy director of the ACLU of Pennsylvania. She says our civic duty is actually pretty narrow.
What does the government require you to do? Pay your taxes. Jury duty. There's the draft.
Some would say obeying the law. But here's the thing, said Feig.
There's tensions in all of those things, right? We, as a society, need to determine what our role and responsibility is to government.
Feig says part of our burden as citizens is figuring out what it means to be a good citizen. For example, Chuck Durham wants to rebuild his neighborhood. For much of his life, Durham has lived in Homewood, a struggling community in Pittsburgh's East End.
A city's only as good as its weakest community. And Homewood right now is the one it needs to love.
Durham attends a monthly meeting of Operation Better Block. It's a nonprofit that represents residents and business owners in Homewood. Operation Better Block and Durham want to see development come to the community. But Durham says for that to happen in a way that doesn't push out residents, he and others have to attend these meetings and make their voices heard.
Don't cry foul if you don't stay involved.
Across town in Greenfield, volunteers climbed a steep hillside to plant trees on a cold Saturday morning. The slope is covered in vines and leaves. Jeff Campbell helps his daughters tamp down the dirt around their wisp of a tree. He says it might not seem like a lot, but everyone doing their own little part adds up.
There's a lot of hard work that kind of keeps it held together, and, you know, things don't improve unless you actually make a concerted effort.
Several saplings away from the Campbells, Gail Woodward digs her feet into the soil, the way a pitcher does. Grounded, she starts digging a broad hole, whacking away at a stubborn root.
I feel like that's why you can get involved in your community and make a difference and just try to make it as better of a place as you can. Yeah, I don't think that I can really make too big of an impact, but I'll sure try.
Despite the cold and the resistance of the soil, the volunteers managed to get 150 trees in the ground. It'll be hard to see for a while, but the saplings will start to hold the hillside in place, keep stormwater from surging into the streets, and clean the air. The neighborhood will start to look a lot different. and hopefully better. Margaret J. Krause, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide initiative reporting on challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY leads the four-station partnership. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.